Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Peter Hansen, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Grinnell College National Poll. Peter, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Jonathan Hasid joins us as well from Iowa State University, where he's Associate Professor of Political Science. Jonathan, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben.
And this hour, a little bit later, we're going to tap into Jonathan's China expertise to talk about Putin's China connection. Obviously, that in the news, and lean on him quite a bit during that part of the program. Before that, Peter Hansen with this fascinating new poll out today, the latest Grinnell College national poll. Later in the hour, we'll also get both of their thoughts on the possible indictment of former President Trump and some other things thrown in as well. But let's start off with your latest poll, Peter. Let's just look at, I'll just rattle off some of the questions that you looked at here. What materials should be available in a school library? Who should make that decision? How strongly do people favor or oppose legislation that would ban transgender children from receiving gender-affirming medical care before they turn 18? Should a teacher inform a student's parents or guardians that student has adopted a gender identity different than the one assigned to them at birth? Should businesses be allowed to refuse service to gays and lesbians based on religious opposition? Of course, these questions are all central to political news we've been dealing with over months and sometimes over years. Join us, listeners, as we walk through some poll results and see if you agree or disagree or have some observations or questions. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Peter, let's dig into the results of this new poll, Grinnell College National Poll, a survey of over 1,000 Americans, 18 and over, March 14th through the 19th. The 19th was just, Sunday, I suppose. And Peter, let's start with attitudes on President Biden and the host of Republicans looking to succeed him. And this is interesting because you track this with this poll over time. What do the latest numbers reveal about President Biden?
Well, we had really two interesting findings about President Biden. The first is that his overall job approval number remains, from historic standards, quite low. We measured him at 39%, which, you know, compared with previous presidents, indicates a president in a very weak position. Now, interestingly, this is the highest we've ever shown the president. He was up 3 points from our last poll, which was conducted 6 months ago. And I think that's largely the result of improving sentiment in the economy. So Americans are still pessimistic about the economy, but not as pessimistic as they were 6 months ago. And I think that's helping the president. But what's really interesting is that normally we would say, you know, a president with this kind of job approval rating is in a pretty weak position heading into an upcoming election. Mm-hmm. But when you compare the president with his potential Republican challengers, then things look a little different. So we also asked about the favorability toward different political figures. And this is a broader kind of question, just a general assessment of whether you like that particular figure. And here, although Biden's number was down slightly from where we measured it before, we have him at 44% favorability right now. He leads the pack of everyone we tested. So he's higher than Donald Trump, and he's higher than Ron DeSantis and other Republican challengers. So even though his position overall is relatively weak, we don't see support coalescing around any particular challenger out there who seems to be doing better.
Mm-hmm. So going more into the implications you see here in terms of, well, we're just under a year away from the GOP Iowa caucuses.
Well, you know, I think as we look at the Republican field, you know, the race right now is shaping up to be between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. Both of them have very high favorability numbers in our poll, both near 80%, with Nikki Haley, who's a declared presidential candidate, trailing quite a bit behind. Now, there's a couple interesting features about these numbers. First of all, Donald Trump is obviously very well known. People have very strong opinions on him. Ron DeSantis, though, despite the fact that he's been in the news quite a bit, is still not as well known as Donald Trump. So even among Republicans, we've got over 10% of people, I think the number is 14%, who don't have an opinion on him. They're not sure whether they're favorable of him or not. Mm-hmm. So his numbers are quite a bit softer. They could move up, they could move down. We'll just have to see as Republicans get to know him a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Peter, we'll pursue some of the other fascinating questions asked in this poll a little bit later, but I want to turn to Jonathan Haseed here. When you look at these poll numbers, specifically to Biden and his GOP rivals there, Jonathan, what jumps out at you?
Well, one thing that jumped out at me was the incredibly high, very unfavorable ratings for Trump. So I was looking at the numbers earlier. I think something like 45% or 46% had very unfavorable opinion of the former president, which, of course, is going to be a major obstacle in any reelection bid. The other thing that struck me was that, you know, Biden's support has improved a bit over the life of the poll, which is interesting. And it's sort of been more stable than I think we might expect, but it's a slow improvement. Looks like it's in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to some of the other questions regarding teaching in this poll, Peter. Education and politics, so much a source of controversy across the country and here in Iowa. The public schools' role in political issues, book bans, gender identity in schools. What specific attitudes did you survey here among Americans?
Well, we've really been struck by the degree to which public schools have been drawn into political controversy in the last several years, really starting with the COVID pandemic and the debate over masking in schools, then proceeding to debates over how to teach about racism in schools, and now bringing in discussions about how to address sexual orientation or gender identity. We've now seen across the nation calls to remove books from school libraries or from classrooms on the grounds that they're not appropriate. So we wanted to touch on all of these things, you know, with a particular focus on debates over what's appropriate to keep in a school library and who should make that decision. And I think there's a couple of really important takeaways here. And the one I'll start with, I think, is the big takeaway. And that is, we asked people whether they are more concerned that valuable materials will be removed from public school libraries or that harmful materials will be available in public school libraries. Mm-hmm. And here the signal from the public was clear. 60% of our respondents said their real concern is that valuable materials will be removed from libraries. So I think even as we're seeing all the sort of heat and fireworks over particular books and particular topics being covered in school libraries, the overall concern from the public is actually that this move is going to go too far, movement's going to go too far, and it's going to lead to valuable books being removed from school libraries.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we asked about a variety of topics, and we used just as a reasonable point of departure, the question of what kind of books or materials should be available in a middle school library. And we chose middle schools because they're at that sort of interesting midpoint in a child's development. And here we asked whether topics about sexual orientation or gender identity or racism in American society or the Bible or the Quran or creationism should be included in a middle school library. So we really tried to run the range here of the kinds of topics that our respondents would be interested in. And what really struck us was that across the board, with every single one of these examples, a majority of people said they wanted those materials to be available in public school libraries. And this just seemed to us to be a strong signal that Americans believe a sound education requires a rich array of materials to be available in a public school library. Now, of course, when you lift up the hood and look at what's going on between Republicans and Democrats, there's a lot of dissension there. So we see that Republicans, for example, strong majorities of them don't want books or materials on sexual orientation or gender identity to be in libraries. Democrats, on the other hand, were comfortable with both of those. But just simply from the overall standpoint of where does the national majority stand, there was strong support for those.
Mm-hmm. Let's get in an email question from Gary in Davenport as we come up to our first break. How reliable and valid is the Grinnell poll? That is, what is the statistical confidence level for your results compared to other polls, especially the poll the Des Moines Register commissions, the Iowa poll? Because some of these same questions, Peter, and you can remind us of that, on a statewide level have been conducted by the Iowa poll. Also, Ann Selzer and company, right?
Sure. That's a great question. Of course, we actually use the same pollster as the Iowa poll, Ann Selzer. Now, the difference is the Iowa poll is just of the state of Iowa, and our poll is a national poll, so our figures reflect national sentiment. But our sample size is 1,004 people. That gives us a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. And so we have a high degree of confidence in these results. This is a nice size sample and a high quality poll.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about this. Jonathan, you come in here, please, in the minute or so we have before the first break. In this part of the poll, what are you seeing? What is of special interest to you?
I noticed that, you know, I was heartened to see that there was a lot of support for keeping controversial materials in the classroom. That was nice to see. Some of the choices that people make in polls are always a little interesting. So I was struck by this question about, there are questions about free speech, a kind of a matrix question. So for each of the questions, whether or not people think it's appropriate or not appropriate for people to speak their minds about politics. And I wonder about this 11% who says it is not appropriate for members of Congress in government buildings to talk about politics. You know, where would they talk about politics then? It was heartening to me to see the numbers relatively supportive of college professors talking about politics in the classroom and other appropriate settings. I appreciated seeing that.
Okay, we'll be back after a short break with our guests, political scientists Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University and Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, where he directs the Grinnell College National Poll. The latest findings, the latest poll results released just today. We want to dig into some more results there. For instance, how strongly do people favor or oppose legislation that would ban transgender children from receiving gender-affirming care? We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
We're back with our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer with political scientists Peter Hansen of Grinnell College, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, talking about the release of the latest Grinnell College national poll, all sorts of fascinating results on our politics, also the intersection of education and politics, which has figured so much into controversial issues over the past months here in Iowa, but also nationally here. Peter, back to the comparison, our listeners, many of us Iowans hearing poll results from the Iowa poll, the Des Moines Register, Mediacom polls releasing, dealing with some of the same issues you do in this poll. And of course, you pointed out that the Iowa poll focuses on the state of Iowa, attitudes among Iowans, whereas your poll here is a national poll representing we hope the attitudes of Americans across the country. When you look at those and you tally, you sort of see, do these poll results in education and gender politics track Iowa seen as more of a blue state now? Does that track when you look at the national results compared to Iowa's results? Iowa State, more of a red state. I made a mistake there.
Yeah. So, as I have looked at the recent Iowa poll and compared it with some of our results, I mean, what it confirms in my mind is that Iowa's taken a pretty sharp right turn in the last several years. I mean, of course, this was the state that voted for Barack Obama twice, and I think was known for being a pretty middle of the road place. This was a place where a very early on same-sex marriage was legalized by the Supreme Court. But our politics really since 2016 have turned very sharply to the right, and that's reflected in public attitudes. And the Iowa polls shows that Iowans are tracking in a much more conservative direction than we see from our national poll.
What do you think, Peter, is the value of polling these issues nationally when so many are decided at a state level?
Well, fundamentally, we simply need to understand the attitudes of the public, and some of them are decided at the state level, but they ultimately get decided at the national level, too. So what we need are, I think, really both kinds of polls. I mean, they're both extremely valuable to try and understand how to factor public attitudes into political decisions.
Mm-hmm. With many states, including Iowa, in the process of or have recently enacting legislation to ban gender-affirming care for transgender individuals under the age of 18, what did you survey here? Tell us more details.
Yeah, well, we were really struck by just the flurry of legislation coming out of the state legislature in Iowa, but also across the nation, are targeting transgender individuals, but also the broader LGBT community. And so we had a number of questions in those areas. And one of them had to do with the ban on gender-affirming care for transgender individuals under the age of 18 that has been passed by the Iowa legislature, and that Governor Reynolds I think hasn't signed yet, but has indicated she will sign.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to know where the public stood on that question. And what we found was that overall, national public opinion is opposed to these kinds of bans. So 53% of Americans believe that states should not be prohibiting gender-affirming care for transgender individuals. And here the question was specific to transgender children who are seeking gender-affirming care with the consent of their parents and working with their doctors. And we were clear about that in the question. This is, of course, not a child acting alone, but with their parents, with their family, and with their doctor.
Mm-hmm. Weigh in here, Jonathan, on these education and gender identity questions. What stands out for you, Jonathan?
Well, you know, these are, I mean, of course, there are, you know, individuals deeply affected by this, the transgender individuals themselves and their family members. But, you know, this is not a huge percentage of the population. And so really this is, you know, a cultural wars kind of an issue. The GOP is trying to rile up conservative supporters on its end to support its general conservative agenda. And, you know, they've found an issue that is, in terms of numbers, not huge across America, but in terms of emotional salience is quite high. And so it's an issue that I expect we'll see more of coming forward.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you also surveyed in this poll Americans about businesses refusing services of all sorts to gay and lesbian customers. This has been an issue for many years. We've seen it before the Supreme Court, and the impetus to poll on this is a pending Supreme Court decision, right?
That's right. Last December, the Supreme Court heard a case coming out of Colorado in which a web designer who wants to start designing websites for weddings sued the state of Colorado because Colorado has an anti-discrimination law that prohibits discrimination against gays and lesbians. And this web designer does not want to design websites for same-sex weddings due to her religious objections to homosexuality. And so really the bottom line here that the Supreme Court has to consider is whether or not a business owner should be able to deny service to gays and lesbians on the basis of religious objections to homosexuality. And so we asked that question to our respondents, and overwhelmingly they said no, a business owner should not be able to discriminate in that way. And it was overwhelming. It was a 2-to-1 margin. Over 2/3 of our respondents felt that this kind of discrimination was unacceptable.
Mm, interesting. We'll see how that Supreme Court decision comes out. But Peter, with the conservative majority in the U.S. Supreme Court, would not be surprising if the U.S. Supreme Court decides Well, in this case, as shown by this poll, against the attitudes of the majority of Americans.
Well, I think those who listened to the oral arguments in the case felt that the conservative justices on the court, who do hold a majority, were favoring the web designer. And, you know, they were making the argument that her right to free expression, you know, and they were treating her work designing websites as a form of expression, couldn't be limited by the state of Colorado. So, in fact, I do think that they will find that she is able to deny service in this way. And I think it causes real problems for the court. I think when the court makes decisions that are squarely against public opinion like this, it reinforces the perception that justices are acting based on their own personal politics and continues this trend we've seen of the court's legitimacy being undermined in the eyes of the public.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, what do we know about how traditionally, at least, the U.S. Supreme Court has figured public attitudes into its decisions? The law, they are to interpret the law, but we know from the past that they get too ahead or behind public opinion. That can have consequences, right, for the legitimacy of the court.
Well, I do think that if the court's job, of course, is to interpret the Constitution and to do that, independently and in theory, independent of what the public thinks is right or is not right. In a practical sense, though, when the court systematically ignores the public and issues decisions that are really contrary to what the public wants, it runs into trouble very quickly. The court's legitimacy, its moral authority, comes from the fact that its decisions are broadly accepted and beyond that, enforced by the elected branches. And if the court is really acting on its own without any support in the public or in the rest of the political system, it finds out pretty quickly that it's powerless.
Mm-hmm. As we wind up this section of our program, looking at the latest Grinnell College National Poll findings, let's go to our callers. Sean is calling from outside of Iowa, in our neighbor to the north in Minnesota. Glad you're listening to Iowa Public Radio. Sean, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Hey, thank you for accepting the call. I just have a general question about the political trend in Iowa that has gone to the right since 2016. I've known for a while that, you know, Iowa did vote for Obama twice, and then suddenly it seems like it's gone to a red state. And I wonder if your guests have any thoughts on the explanations or a reason or some of the issues that have been driving voters to the different political direction?
Yeah, that is a question, that umbrella question, a big question for all kinds of political scientists, not only in Iowa, but across the country. Jonathan Hasid, can you take a crack at answering Sean's question in Minnesota?
I can take a crack at it. Peter maybe would be better to fill this one in. But I can, one thing we know is that, of course, the U.S. has gotten dramatically more polarized in the last 6 or 7 years politically. And so we would expect that there would be fewer and fewer battleground states, right? That the states would spread out more toward their corners, if you like. And we also know that, it's not obviously not the exclusive driver of Donald Trump's support in Iowa and other places, but a large driver of his support is high levels of racial resentment among white Americans. And that does seem to be linked with higher levels of Trump voting. And so, there's some argument to be made, and again, Peter maybe should weigh in on this, that actually the election of Barack Obama was a turning point in heightening racial resentment among many white Americans who feel that they're perhaps losing their privileged status in society. Now, I can't really speak to that debate, but that's my understanding from the fringes of it.
Mm-hmm. Peter, weigh in here, please.
Well, I think there, what we've noticed in Iowa, but also across the nation, is the movement of white non-college educated voters from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And this isn't just happening in Iowa. It's noticeable in Iowa because we have a large population of non-college educated voters. But it's also happening in northern Minnesota. Right? It's happening up in the Iron Range, which used to be overwhelmingly Democratic and now has shifted Republican. But it's not just an American phenomenon. It's happening in England. If you look at, north of England, where the Labour Party used to have strongholds in In manufacturing cities, those have shifted conservative too. So it's actually a global phenomenon and one that I think political scientists are really working hard to understand. But I do think it has to do with sort of a overall backlash against, you know, greater cultural liberalism in the United States, but also the West more broadly, and that's pushing working class voters out of the traditional parties of the left into conservative parties.
Peter Hansen with us of Cornell College, Jonathan Aseed of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. So glad you're on board. Jonathan, let's turn to your wheelhouse. You're a China expert. Briefly, some of the headlines that I've been seeing here. The U.S. says now it will send tanks to Ukraine sooner than expected. The M1 Abrams tanks get there by the fall. Pentagon saying yesterday, initially, we remember officials saying it could take up to a couple years. Ukrainian President Zelensky visiting the front line near Bakhmut. This is where those fierce fighting is raging on. And this comes as the Japanese and Chinese leaders visit opposing capitals in this war. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida was in Kyiv, where he is promising unwavering support to the Ukrainian president, talk of reconstruction, humanitarian aid. And then what has garnered a lot of attention, of course, China's Xi Jinping in Moscow, having been described by Russia's President Putin as a friend and partner. As a China expert, Jonathan, what do you make of these visits by the leaders of Asian powers?
It shows how Asia is diverging rather quickly. You know, Japan is rearming. Japan is investing heavily in its military, in spite of the fact that the Japanese constitution places serious limits on what the Japanese military can and can't do. And, you know, they're doing this because of the threat that they perceive from China. And so, you know, where 10 or 15 years ago, you would have had Asian leaders treading more cautiously about coming down on sides of a world conflict like this. Now, you know, we have two leaders from the two major powers in Asia really planting their flags on opposite sides of the world. And it's really quite striking. The thing that interested me most about Xi Jinping's visit to Moscow is that if you recall last year, right before the invasion, a couple of weeks before the invasion, in early February 2022, China and Russia announced that they had a limitless partnership, a partnership with, quote, no limits. Mm-hmm. And then this was just weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine. It was striking to me to see that rhetoric is gone from the press releases that the Chinese and Russian governments put out. There's not any more talk about limitless partnership. Instead, there's sort of more boilerplate about working together and defending sovereignty and creating, opposing a U.S. unipolar-led order. So it suggests to me that Xi Jinping has, although, of course, he's visiting Moscow and very visibly offering his support and friendship to Vladimir Putin, it suggests that the Chinese government's official position has backed off a little bit from so-called limitless partnership. The Chinese have not, as far as we know, been delivering arms in any substantial quantities to the Russians. Chinese banks have refrained from financing Russian operations and this kind of thing. So, Xi Jinping is trying to toe a careful line here. He's trying to not upset the Europeans and Ukraine. And of course, he's trying to stay Russia's good graces as well all the time, while also strategically competing with the U.S. and with other places like India and Japan in the region.
And zooming out here to the global geopolitics here, our Secretary of State Blinken quoted as saying, you know, the post-Cold War era is over, sort of to paraphrase, sort of now we're on a race to determine the next geopolitical order. And when we look at what China did in the Middle East, brokering peace there, it wants to assume a different role, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So China, as you say, just a few weeks ago brokered, I mean, we don't know how extensive it is, but brokered a kind of a detente, at least, between traditional enemies, Iran and Saudi Arabia, in an area that has, you know, traditionally been seen as part of America's backyard. Of course, Saudi Arabia has been a longtime American ally and client state. And so to have the Chinese move in and deal with the Saudis directly is new. And it shows a new boldness on China's approach. You're absolutely right, Ben, that China's approach on foreign affairs used to be, there's a Chinese expression meaning to bide your time and wait. And that used to be the heart of Chinese foreign affairs, is essentially waiting for the country to get rich enough so that they can impose their will on the global stage. But before that time, keeping quiet and not getting into too much trouble, Xi Jinping has thrown that completely out the window. And although China has not formally come down on the Russian side in the war, it's clear rhetorically that, you know, Beijing is very much on board with the war, and whatever ties that that Ukraine has in terms of Chinese influence. So, you know, Ukraine and China are in fact major trading partners, and so it's interesting to me that Xi Jinping has not met, in spite of repeated invitations, Xi Jinping has not met with Zelensky, with the Ukrainian prime minister.
Yeah.
And, there doesn't seem to be any indication that it's going to happen anytime soon. And it shows that, this aggressiveness, this newfound aggressiveness, this kind of foreign policy assertiveness, potentially comes with some downsides for the Chinese leadership.
We'll return after a short break with Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, one of our political scientists on board, as well as Peter Hansen of Grinnell College. Join our conversation 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Peter Hansen with us of Grinnell College. Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Let's finish up, gentlemen, talking a little bit more about China and Ukraine, that connection there. Before I want to add another question for Jonathan here, but Peter, you've been listening in on Jonathan as with his China expertise. What are your observations on the latest developments here when we see, the Chinese leader, the Japanese leader on different sides of this conflict, making visits, sending signals?
Well, I think there are a couple of observations I have. One is that even as we are playing this very aggressive role supporting Ukraine and its conflict with Russia, there's a brewing isolationist sentiment happening back in the United States, which I think really became clear when Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, likely presidential candidate, said that he felt we were going too far supporting Ukraine. And so I think as we look ahead to 2024, we can potentially see a very sharp divergence in the path we're going to take, right? If President Biden would get reelected, I think we would stay the course. But there is another scenario here where the United States really pulls back from the world, freeing Russia to take much stronger action in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, picking up where Peter left off there, we had Ron DeSantis talking about, I think the quote there is, we should not be getting involved in this, I think, territorial dispute. They're making it, the smallest of possible interpretations of the significance of this conflict, Jonathan, right? Which goes against what we've been hearing a lot from the Biden administration, which is this is a threat to democracy. This is authoritarianism versus democracy on a world stage.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that the isolationist, this sort of neo-isolationism that Peter mentioned is coming not just, although largely from the right and the Republican Party, elements of the Republican Party, also from the far left as well. And so there's an interesting convergence. You can think about the horseshoe theory of politics, where actually the extremes are in some ways closer to each other than they are to the middle. And that seems to be an interesting case where you have common cause from leftist anti-war activists and from people like Ron DeSantis, who are both saying that they want to keep the U.S. out of foreign conflicts. at least for now, that doesn't seem to be the majority view in either party, although the GOP seems to be split about 50-50 on this issue right now. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in the primaries.
An alternative view here, Jonathan, your reaction, and I'm sure you're aware of the work of Professor John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago. He's become somewhat of an unlikely celebrity in the wake of this invasion of Ukraine. He has argued for years that the West has provoked a war in Ukraine by pursuing policies that Russia saw as an existential threat. That's a phrase he uses again and again. In particular, he has repeatedly argued that it was a folly for the U.S. to promise to bring Ukraine into NATO, predicted that Russia would not tolerate this, and that the end result would be, in his words, that Ukraine is going to get wrecked. And that's a prediction he made years ago, which has, you know, put the spotlight on him. What do you make of Mearsheimer's framing of this conflict like that?
I think Mearsheimer is completely wrong, and I think Mearsheimer has done great disservice to his academic legacy by saying things like he had an interview with the New Yorker where, among other things, he said he didn't see any evidence that Vladimir Putin was interested in imperialism. I mean, Vladimir Putin every day is talking about rebuilding the Russian Empire, you know, recapturing the glory of the Soviet Union, and sort of just pretend that Putin isn't saying those things and that this is all driven by the West is really problematic. The other problematic part about what Mearsheimer has done is that his, when he talks, his theories seem to indicate that only the U.S. has any agency in the world, right? The U.S. is what made Russia invade. The U.S. is what forced Vladimir Putin's hand. Surely the Russian government has some agency too here. And Vladimir Putin made this decision, I think, all by himself. You know, Joe Biden did not force Vladimir Putin to invade, and Mearsheimer's sort of implication that the U.S. is responsible for everything that happens in the world is quite ridiculous and has, I think, greatly diminished his academic standing.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the final part of our little triad here of political controversies this week on our Politics Wednesday. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office appears poised to seek an indictment of former President Donald Trump. The facts in this case, and there are many cases, but in this one case, former President Trump's one-time fixer, Michael Cohen, will testify in this case that Donald Trump directed him to pay off the porn star Stormy Daniels and that the former president reimbursed Cohen and helped cover the whole thing up. Let me read just as a way of introducing this part of our program. I always love the writing of Nate Cohn of the New York Times. He likened it to getting our bearings from one of those, quote, old, yellowish, distorted maps from the age of exploration. It offers only a rough guide as what lies ahead, he wrote. We're approaching uncharted waters. The front runner for the majority party nomination for president may soon be indicted. This is the blurry corner of the map where we can't do much more than draw fantastical sea creatures. We know this part of the world is probably ocean, but we don't know much else. We're sure it's dangerous. Peter Hansen, however much you like that parallel there, what are your thoughts on the territory, unlike any previous in American history, that we appear to be entering?
Well, I do think we are in uncharted waters in some respect, but I think there are some, you know, ideas we can keep in mind as we try and navigate them. You know, one is, fundamentally, no one is above the law in the United States, and that is a bedrock principle of American law. And for that reason, if a former president broke the law, they can still be held accountable in the criminal justice system, and that's just the way it goes. Second is, I don't think there is any scenario under which the supporters of Donald Trump will ever believe that charges, if they are brought forward, are not politically motivated. And will not dismiss them as, you know, just sort of another effort to go after President Trump. And, you know, what that means is we're in an extraordinarily difficult place for our democracy, because as a democracy, we don't want our law enforcement to be drawn into political campaigns. I mean, this is why we have norms of behavior that are so important, right? We don't want our candidates standing in front of a crowd and saying things like, you know, in my day we would punch protesters in the face or that sort of thing. We don't want political candidates breaking the law. We want them to follow norms of behavior, not just objectively because it's good, but because when we pull law enforcement into politics, it creates enormous problems. It creates the perception and the possibility that law enforcement could be used for political ends. Mm-hmm. We never want to be in a situation where there's even a question that a prosecution is politically motivated or that an incumbent administration is using law enforcement to go after their political enemies, right? But when you have somebody that's breaking the law and law enforcement has to act, it will always raise that question, right? Which is why we need a better standard of behavior from our candidates. So that's a long way of answering your question, Ben, but that's my view.
Jonathan, we want to play some reaction, focus on in just a moment, reaction that appears to be somewhat divided in the GOP among GOP leaders. But before we do that, Jonathan, respond to Peter or with other thoughts here.
Yeah, of course. You know, when you have a large percentage of people in a democracy who, regardless of what the electoral outcome is, refuse to accept it because their chosen candidate lost, then that puts the country in a very serious place. And there's just no way to sugarcoat that. The thing that actually has scared me most about the reaction to Trump's possible impending arrest is what the GOP has done in the House. So you have people like, Jim Jordan decrying, you know, sending a letter to the Manhattan DA asking him not to do this. They're talking about, I mean, ironically, for someone who sits on a brand new committee that's supposed to be about finding out the areas where the federal government has been so-called weaponized against political opponents, it seems to me that Congressman Jordan and his colleagues are doing exactly the same thing by threatening to cut funding, federal funding, from a state court over which they should have no oversight at all. You also have things like, I think it was Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky who tweeted that he wants to lock up the New York district attorney.
Yeah. Yep.
Jail him, he says. Yeah. No crime has been specified, right? Alan Bragg is not the one who is, as far as we know, is not the one who's committed any crimes. And yet the GOP is circling their wagons around him. This tells me that, unfortunately, there's a lot of the Republican Party that is perfectly willing to destroy the American procedural justice system if it means protecting the former president.
It's
really awful.
Yeah, in that vein, let's go over to the U.S. Senate and a quote, some audio from Lindsey Graham, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican of South Carolina, giving a warning that an indictment from the Manhattan District Attorney, this Alvin Bragg, could mean, what it could mean for the nation. This is part of an interview he did for Fox and Friends this week.
Yeah, it's going to blow up our country, and this is a bunch of BS. You've had the prosecutor before Bragg, Mr. Vance, look at the case and pass on it. You had the U.S. attorney in New York say, I'm not going to do it federally. Right. There was an intervening cause other than Trump running. One of the guys in the DA's office wrote a book very critical of Vance. You should have prosecuted right. Trump. You let him off, and Bragg feels that pressure. He's a George Soros-backed prosecutor. He can't take the heat. So the guy is yielding to the political pressure generated by the former prosecutor, and this is a case without merit, in my view. Donald Trump will be the only person in the history of New York prosecuted under this theory.
John, Peter, before you react, let me play another voice, notably from the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, Republican, pushing back on former President Trump's calls for protests during a press conference on Sunday. This is Kevin McCarthy. He remarks coming a day after Trump predicted, we remind ourselves, on Truth Social, his social media network, that he would be arrested yesterday, Tuesday, and called for his followers to, quote, protest, take our nation back. McCarthy urged for calmness and against any violence in this clip that was edited for Time.
It doesn't matter what side of the issue you're on. It doesn't matter if this was President Trump or if this was a Democrat. It should be equal justice in America. And stop going after people because you have political differences.
I don't think people should protest this, no. And I think President Trump, if you talk to him, he doesn't believe that either. I mean, I think the thing that you may misinterpret when President Trump talks, when someone says that they can protest, he would probably be referring to my tweet, educate people about what's going on. He's not talking in a harmful way, and nobody should.
Peter Hansen comment on that fairly generous interpretation, Kevin McCarthy, that this is a Donald Trump's tweets are an educational in aspiration there.
Well, I mean, I think obviously the speaker is you know, not wanting to confront former President Trump on this. I mean, the fact is Donald Trump has a track record of trying to rile up the public, you know, to come to his defense when he's feeling under siege. And that's exactly what happened on January 6th with terrible consequences with the storming of the Capitol. The larger lesson I draw here is that when a president breaks the law or appears to break the law or creates a cause for to be investigated, it puts the country in a lose-lose position, right? Because we neither want to say that that individual is above the law, but the chaos that is invited by having to investigate a former president is immense, particularly when there don't seem to be any circumstances under which the president's defenders will acknowledge wrongdoing. So it's I just see it as a lose-lose for the country and, you know, one of the many sort of impossible situations we've been placed in by this unusual political figure of Donald Trump.
Let's squeeze in one caller before we end this Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Tom calling from Des Moines, coming up on the end of our hour. Tom, sure glad you're with us.
Yes, long-term listener, sometimes caller. I wanted to join your commentators in, I think they're condemning this rather universal Republican talking point of saying that Trump being prosecuted now is all political. And this is something that every defender of law and order, every defender of democratic institutions has to condemn. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think journalists like those on your program need to say as strong language as possible that this kind of reading into law and order activities, political motivations, is just condemnatory. It's just not right.
Okay, Tom in Des Moines, thank you so much. Let's end this with, a central or perhaps the central question around this. Have you each take a stab at it. You first, Jonathan. Will an indictment help Trump or hurt him in his quest to reclaim the Republican nomination and perhaps the presidency?
That's a great question. You know, it may help him in the short run gain some momentum in the GOP nomination. I mean, I think he's likely to be the nominee anyway, whether he's indicted or not. So in the short run, it may help him, you know, consolidate support among Republicans who feel that he's being unfairly mistreated and railroaded and so on. But in the long run, it can't help. You know, Trump has a lot of baggage. This is just one more thing. There are other likely indictments coming later on. And, you know, every additional drip, even if it doesn't peel off that many supporters, is still demoralizing a few, peeling off a few, and the drips just never seem to end. So I don't, you know, he lost before. I don't see how it strengthens his hand in the general election to be under indictment.
Mm-hmm. Peter Hansen, in a minute or less, your final thoughts.
Yeah, I just think there are a lot of Republicans who are looking ahead to 2024 and believe that Trump can't win a national election. You know, he lost the last one, and he alienates independent voters who are vital for a Republican victory. And they would desperately like to see someone else as their front runner. But the fact is, they don't control Republican voters who still have strong support for Donald Trump and who may very well vote for him in the nomination. And so those voters may hand the nomination to former President Trump, regardless of what elected officials on the Republican side may think behind the scenes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter Hansen, Associate Professor of Political Science, Director of the Grinnell College National Poll. Jonathan Hasid, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with former State Representative Phyllis Thede. She began serving the Iowa legislature during the Obama administration, and we'll get her reflections on her time of service over 7 terms in the Iowa legislature as a black woman.